Welcome to Musings from Sam Houston's Stomping Grounds, a production of the Newton Gresham Library at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas.
This is Michelle Martinez, reference librarian at Newton Gresham Library, interviewing Dr. Hirono Nath, professor of economics, and here today to discuss whatever, economics related. So tell me, you were saying that your name is a Sanskrit name.
Yes, first of all, thank you for having me here. I'm glad. Hirono is a Sanskrit word, and it means gold.
I like that. You're an economics person, and your name is gold.
That's probably a coincidence.
I know, they say names shape people, right?
I don't know.
So you have multiple degrees. It looks like they overlap. You have a master's and an MPhil.
Yeah, I have got three masters. MPhil is also a master's,
oh,
right?
Oh, it is. Okay.
It's like, well, I think in the U.S. only few places actually have offered a program like MPhil, which is somewhere between like a master's and a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a master's with a thesis option, so you have to write a thesis. So I have three masters in economics.
Oh so my, you must really like the subject.
No, not really. At least not when I was doing those masters. It's actually by accident, I guess, because I did my first master's at Delhi School of Economics, which is kind of a top institution for economics in India. And then I was thinking of coming to the United States, but at that point my father told me that, well, you have to take care of your brother who wanted to go to a school in Delhi.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in Delhi at that time. And he said, well, but I have some financial problems, so... Well, he did not say that, actually. He said, well, but you'll have to somehow manage, somehow mm-hmm. support your brother. So he came to Delhi to go to a school, and so I started working for a while. And after 2 years, he got his degree, and then he decided to go back to Assam, where I'm from. And then I said, okay, now I have to pursue what I want mm-hmm. to pursue, and then... But immediately, I didn't have enough savings to apply to universities in the United States. So I got into a PhD program in another university in Delhi, which is Jawaharlal Nehru University, another top schools there. So in the meantime, I started applying here in the US. So after 2 years of study in that program, I actually got a master's. That's how I got my second degree. And then when I came to US, to SMU, then of course PhD program is 5 years, and when you complete 30 credit hours, then you get another master's. So that's how I...
Oh, wow, okay.
That's how I end up having three masters.
Is the way the subject matter is taught, is it different between...
Not exactly. Where I went to school in India, because Delhi School of Economics, the program is very much kind of designed according to or like the programs in the United States. So many of the stuff that I did there, I did here too. But we had to study, for example, Indian economy, which, well, mm-hmm. very few schools probably will teach that as a separate field.
Right.
And then there was an... when I was in undergrad, we had to do something called the history of economic thought, which we don't teach in most of the programs here in the United States. There are some schools where they teach history of economic thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
I think in India, well, we had to do history of economic thought, and then also we had to do comparative economic systems. Of course, here we teach comparative economic systems, but there we have to really study, for example, Marxism, capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Here it's more like an elective subject, but there it was a compulsory subject. So I think those are a few minor differences.
So, was there anything else you were interested in besides economics that you thought about going into, or how did you get into economics?
Well, that's, I can give you a very short answer, I can give you a very long answer, because it was by accident, I guess.
Whichever answer you'd like to give.
So, if I have to give you the long answer, then I have to tell you a little bit about my background.
Okay, go ahead.
So, I was born and brought up in a very small rural community in India. So, until I finished high school, I was there, never went anywhere. And my family was low income. Mm-hmm. By American standard, it would be poor.
Right.
So my parents could not afford a lot of things. But somehow, I went to public school, which did not have good buildings, meaning did not have roofs. In fact,
oh,
did
no.
not have electricity. But then we were told that you have to study math, science, English. And you do that, or you just go down the drain. So there's no other option. But somehow I really worked hard and did very well when I graduated from high school. And at that point, I did not know much what to do because none of my parents actually went to college. So, they said, okay, whatever you want to do, we'll try to support. But then it was difficult for them to tell me that, okay, these are your options. So at that point, I came to Delhi with two of my friends. I was just traveling.
Mm-hmm.
And then I met some students who were going to school in Delhi University. And they said, okay, you have such a good background. Why don't you apply for undergraduate program here? And at that point, I did not come to Delhi to get into an undergrad program. But that was the summer when the admission, the admission process was going on. So I said, okay, I'll try. But then what subject? Then somebody said, oh, you probably can do economics. But I was good at math. I was as good at statistics, so I thought maybe I can do math. But then some of those folks that I met there, they said, no, do economics, it's a good subject. And so I got into the economics program. And unlike in the United States, you have to pick your major in the very beginning and you cannot change it.
So
it's a very rigid system. And at that point, I did not know why I chose economics because coming out of high school, mm-hmm. economics actually was my weakest subject in terms of my score. And so I got into the economics program in a very good college under University of Delhi. And then I think I got stuck. It was in the beginning, it was like an arranged marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not really enjoy until actually I came to the United States. I think I started loving the subject after I came to U.S. for my doctorate. And as you know, it's like I have been doing economics so long now. it's for me, it's a way of thinking. So
I always, and I'm sure other people have incorrectly thought that economics needed a basis in math. So it's not really math heavy. Is it more theory than it is?
Actually, it's math heavy. Yeah.
It is?
Yeah, you have to have a good background in mathematics. So all along, whenever I was doing economics, I also did mathematics. And particularly the programs in the United States, the doctoral programs, they are very math-oriented. It's almost like first 1 year at least in a doctoral program. At points, you would think that what am I doing? Is it economics? It's basically math, applied math. Yeah.
All right, so I'll stick to English then. No math for me.
So yeah, it's very math oriented. Yes.
So when you said that your background in economics is pretty weak in high school, what was the difference between the math and the yeah, the economics that you were doing back there.
So in high school, the Indian school system is different from the American system.
Mm-hmm.
So after 10th grade, when you go to your junior and senior years, you actually have to choose whether you want to go to science stream or art stream or commerce stream. So there are three different streams.
Okay.
So I decided to go to the art stream. But then in arts, you can actually choose to have mathematics, very advanced math.
That's interesting.
And then you can choose economics, you can choose statistics. Obviously, you cannot choose physics, chemistry. Those are kind of pure science. But in art stream, these are kind of semi-science, so that's what I chose. I chose math, I chose economics, I chose statistics, and I chose something called logic.
Oh, okay.
So it's not pure arts or humanities. It's kind of semi-science. So because I really studied mathematics and I did very well.
High school in India sounds pretty tough.
Yeah, it's very rigid system, unlike in the United States. Once you choose something, you cannot change it.
So. Do they test towards are you schooled towards testing? Like here we have the tests that you have to pass in order to move on, or is it more about the subject matter there, that they're interested in you learning that rather than teaching you towards a test?
Now, there are a couple of things. Nowadays, there is a misconception out in the outside world that India has a very good education system, which is not true.
Mm-hmm.
India actually has a very lousy education system. They're trying hard to do better. We have to take those tests. For example, after 10th grade, we had to take a statewide exam.
Okay.
And then after 11th and 12th, which is basically the junior and senior years, again you have to take a statewide exam. And we prepare for that. And it's very test-oriented system. But then, at least back then, when I grew up in the 80s, there was heavy emphasis on science, maths, and English. But mainly on science and maths, because everybody wanted to become engineer or doctors. And that's why we have a huge number of doctors and engineers. And if you take the number as a percentage of the population, because India has 1.2 billion people, so it's very tiny, but then in absolute number it's quite big. We have got many engineering schools. Not all the engineering schools are pretty good. There are few of them which are world class, and that's kind of our road to fame, I guess, because that's how people outside the world, they know about Indian engineering programs or medical programs, and they are pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you go beyond, let's say, Delhi or Bangalore or Mumbai, like other places, these educational institutions are not that very high standard.
So if you're mentioning those cities, those are the more economically developed cities.
That's
too,
correct.
Right?
That's correct.
So how did you, speaking of economics, the British, when they left, did they leave any of their systems that...
Yeah, most of the systems that we have, even now, we basically inherited them from the British. Yes.
And so a lot of them aren't working anymore, have you noticed them building on what was already there, or have they just started over from the beginning and...
No, they are building. I mean, they're trying to kind of build around what we already have. India hasn't completely shut down the system and then have started building.
I guess you couldn't do that without...
Yeah, that's difficult. But then they're trying to build around it. Education has been a big challenge, and in the last about 10 years, starting from about 2001, Indian the federal government, we call central government, is kind of putting a lot of emphasis on primary and secondary education, which was not the case, because immediately after independence, our first prime minister, he put a lot of emphasis on higher education, and that's how we ended up having all those world-class engineering schools and science-oriented institutions like Indian Institute of Technology, Indian Institute of Management, and Indian Institute of Science. These are like top, world-class institutions. But then there are only few. So how many students they can take in? So so if you look at the output, well, we have got, and you would expect that in a population of 1.2 billion, there will be smart people, there will be bright kids, right? And then they go out and they do well. And, but then for the majority, it's like there is not much emphasis on the elementary and secondary education, as a result of which we still have about 40% illiterate people who are illiterate. 40% of 1.2 billion is pretty big.
That's a lot.
Yeah. And then we have a democratic system, like a democracy, where you would think that people should be at least literate.
Right.
So it's kind of a, the more I think about India, it fascinates me, because the things still work in the country. It's a kind of a very amazing balance of things. Balance of some kind of supernatural power.
Very delicate balance.
Yeah, that's right.
So with all this schooling that you ended up doing, how many theses did you actually end up writing?
I wrote one thesis for my MPhil, and then for my
and then for your doctorate?
Doctorate, I wrote one and the one. Yeah.
Okay, so only two. I was thinking you'd written one for everything you had done.
No.
So that's a lot.
No.
So is there a subject matter that you find yourself repeating in your topics when you write, not just like your articles as well?
Well, since I finished my PhD in 2002, I've been writing. Monetary economics is my area of specialization, and I look at the price behavior, how prices move over time, go up, go down, and generally. The major focus of that literature is on inflation. So people talk about inflation all the time. But inflation is just one number, right? It's kind of an average aggregate price.
Okay.
But then behind that, beneath that, there are all kinds of movements in prices. Right? Some prices go up, some prices go up by 10%, some prices go up by 5%, some prices probably have gone down. So there are a lot of movements in relative prices. So that's what I look at.
So prices, and what specifically do you look at? I don't know, like tuna or anything in particular?
Yeah, food prices. I look at even prices for different services. The last couple of years, I have published a few papers on looking at prices in different cities across the United States. Which is kind of a interesting topic, because prices means, well, that also determines cost of living in different cities, and you know that cost of living is different in different cities.
Right.
And so what, how they are kind of changing over time, and what are the implications for things like, okay, where people want to live, or where people want to work, or where people want to invest, those kind of things. So those are implications of what I have been doing, but it's one part of my research is very technical. It's like, well, there are policy implications, there are implications, but then some of the stuff that I do, it's kind of, I look at the technical problems in that literature. So
it sounds like a giant spider web, like economics. You're not able to separate it out from policy, from whatever's going on in the world, from culture. It's all
It's very in some sense it's, well, it's not rocket science. It's common sense. But then we try to treat all the issues, common sense issues, in a very sophisticated way. I think that's what we do in a discipline. And then also economics has become more and more interdisciplinary. And some of the, when you look at the top journals, you will look at some of the articles and you will wonder why would we write about this in economics, or why an economist would write about this particular topic. But then, so I mean, the point is economics is kind of very broad in a way. Mm-hmm. So we are now, and many of these people, many of the economists, they are working in the intersections of disciplines, I guess. So it kind of moves into, for example, sociology, psychology, and the other other areas. And one of the areas that I have been working for the last couple of years is information economics, which is kind of pretty exciting and interesting for me. It's got a lot of implications for future employment, future education policy in the United States.
Okay, so what is information economics?
So it's basically the economics driven by ICT, information and communication technology.
Okay.
So I did a paper where I have shown that in U.S. economy, about 60% of the economy is all information. So that means every dollar that you spend in the United States, 60 cents goes to information-related product or information-related services.
Wow.
And which is amazing, right?
Like, yeah.
And one of my co-authors from UCLA, he uses a term called the service industrialization, where information is a big part.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know that U.S. economy is basically a service economy. Here, more than 80% of the income comes from services. Almost 80% of the workforce is in the services. And services also become more information-intensive services. Things like what you do is an information-intensive service. What
right.
I do is an information-intensive service, right? And the other kind of very interesting structural change that has been taking place in the U.S. is this kind of the economy is moving towards information-intensive services.
Mm-hmm.
And one part of that story is what my co-author calls service industrialization, which is basically characterized by automation, meaning, let's say, bank teller job is actually an information-intensive job, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's being replaced by ATM machines.
Okay.
A travel agent job is an information-intensive job.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's being, or information-intensive service is being replaced by the software.
Mm-hmm.
You don't now go to, I have not been to a travel agent for ages.
Oh, right.
Right? So automation is one big part.
Mm-hmm.
Then outsourcing or offshoring, which is basically, well, instead of doing the part of the service here, you do somewhere else. It doesn't have to be overseas, but it can be within the country. And that's something very interesting, because service by definition is something that both the producer and consumer have to be somehow together. They are
right.
They have, services are co-produced.
Mm-hmm.
But that has changed because of the technology now. You can actually produce different parts of services in different places and bring it, assemble it, and deliver it to the consumer, which has been happening in manufacturing for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, the car that you drive, different
right.
parts are produced in different places and they are brought together here and assembled in a
mm-hmm.
factory somewhere in Mexico or somewhere in Detroit or somewhere
mm-hmm.
in Georgia or Alabama, right? So that's how, and that and then it is delivered. But that was not possible in case of service. But nowadays it is possible even in service. One example that I give all the time is my job, teaching job. Now, in a traditional way, how I teach, well, I choose my textbook,
mm-hmm.
I read it, I make notes, right? I go to the class, I write it in the board,
mm-hmm.
The students take notes, and then I assign homework assignments, and they kind of submit the homework assignments, then I grade it, and then I put those grades in the grade sheet. So that's
mm-hmm.
how I teach in class in a traditional way. But nowadays, lot of parts of this process, I don't do. For example, when I chose the book comes with very nice PowerPoint slides, which were probably made by somebody sitting in India or sitting in Czech Republic or
mm-hmm.
Hungary or somewhere. And so my only job is to go to the classroom and basically deliver the lecture. And after that, I assign homework. And homeworks are submitted online. They are graded by a software
mm-hmm.
and automatically sent to my Blackboard or wherever I want. So what I am doing, my role is basically I am assembling these different parts of this service called education,
okay.
and I'm delivering it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that has happened in education. That has happened in health,
mm-hmm.
or healthcare, for example. A lot of medical transcriptions are nowadays done in India. So they do the test here, send it electronically to India. Some radiologists there, they will sit and
mm-hmm.
kind of look over and send it back, transmit it back to the doctor here, and then they will go over it. So again, as you can see, that assembly process is also a big part of what my Gothor calls the service industrialization. So given that, now that is possible, so
mm-hmm.
what are the kind of jobs that our students are looking at when they go out and look for jobs in two,
right.
3-4 years. So that's one part of what I do.
Wow.
It's like, briefly, that is, but there are many other small
mm-hmm.
little stories around that, but that's so much so that actually I work with a group at UCLA, and I got to know somebody at IBM, and they are trying to develop a new discipline called Service Enterprise Engineering,
okay.
or Service Science. And in some of the schools around the globe, they have started offering courses. And so kind of looking ahead, you will have an engineering discipline called service engineering. So you will have service engineers.
Okay.
So they will be very specialized in
mm-hmm.
kind of dealing with the problems with services.
So with the way that we seem to be taking apart everything economically, like now that we're individualizing things, do you think as we go forward in the future that people are going to be more disciplined or more
specialized?
More specialized?
Yes. Yes, I do think so.
How do you think that's going to affect just...
Well, the economic argument would be it makes the system more efficient because you know something very little, small things very well. That means you will be probably the most productive person.
Okay.
Right? The danger is how you coordinate these
mm-hmm.
different pieces. Because if I think about, like, I sometimes talk to my colleagues at the department, and they say that how in 70s, 60s, people knew everything. Like,
right.
if your car breaks down, they knew what was
mm-hmm.
the wrong, and they could probably fix it. And now, when I look at, and I don't know, even for me, like, if my car breaks down, I'll go crazy because I don't know anything
right.
about the machine, right? So that's kind of the downside of if you think that is a downside
right.
of being too specialized because you don't know what the other part is doing or what you don't know much
mm-hmm.
about anything else
having
and,
to rely on
and
someone
as a
else.
Result it's become very the system become interdependent, become very complex
mm-hmm.
and that's actually part of this new discipline that IBM is trying to with other universities around the world they're trying to develop because it becomes such a complex system.
Mm-hmm.
So you need some specialists to kind of manage that system.
Right.
So that's one of the objectives of their
mm-hmm.
idea of developing a service science because the system has become so specialized and it kind of brings in a lot of complexity to how the world works.
I can imagine. I mean, if one of the people who specializes in this small little widget, mm-hmm. you know, gets sick, dies, whatever, doesn't come to work, everything else just falls apart because no one else is able to fill mm-hmm. fill that area. So are there going to be people who need to specialize in what, I don't know, what we used to call generalists? Are they just going to have to be really good at lots of little different things and be like the manager? Is that
the
idea?
Yeah, generalist, again, I mean, it's... well, I think there will still be generalists, but then mm-hmm. I think people are...
well, I'm probably thinking way into the future.
I mean, if you take examples from your day-to-day life, I think more and more we kind of try to go to the specialist than going to generalists to talk about. So mm-hmm. that's what... And things are changing in a very things are changing very rapidly, and I keep telling my colleagues that, well, I think our jobs are in danger because we are mm-hmm. Because of all these developments, we are going to lose our jobs very quickly, very soon. Probably there will be a time when you don't need that many professors. Like, what do we do? One big part of our job is to teach the same thing over and over and over and again. Mm-hmm. Like, and when we teach undergraduate, well, we make a little variation, but then we don't need a PhD to do those kind of things. So, and technology is already there where the best teacher in the world can actually teach a worldwide class.
Right.
Where if I'm not good at teaching, why should I be in the class? So then what do I do? So we probably should move more towards more creative, more innovative, because that's where the utility of our skill, or that's where our skills or training or experience are most needed.
So if you're not going to teach economics in the future, what are you going to do?
No, I think I'll be doing, because if I don't teach, still I can be, that's why research becomes such an important part of me, because, or should be important mm-hmm. part of everybody who teaches,
right.
who are university professors, I guess. Because again, as I said, if not for the fear of losing the job, teaching job, mm-hmm. but also like when I described how the nature of my job has changed,
mm-hmm.
like instead of doing all these different parts of my job, I just assemble different parts nowadays. So that also frees up a lot of time for me. Now, what am I expected to do watch mm-hmm. basketball games or do something else?
Mm-hmm.
Probably if I want to keep my job, I'll have to do more research than mm-hmm. watching basketball games or whatever you do for so that's challenging, and that's why, I mean, that means what? You spend more time on creative, more innovative work means that will be the demand for, that is where the demand lies, I think, future. And American job markets will be, I mean, outside those political rhetoric where people mm-hmm. say that, oh, we'll bring back all the manufacturing jobs that has gone to China, no, that is not going to happen. And politicians can say that, but
right.
that doesn't make any economic sense. And they're not coming back. So what are the jobs that will be available for the American workforce? So they will have to, education will be a very big, important part, kind of looking forward in the labor market here.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be more around like this innovation, creativity, those kind of jobs. So.
Okay. So, how do you keep up with just what's going on in economics today? I mean, are there certain journals or certain newspapers you're constantly reading, constantly subscribing to? Because I'd imagine you have to constantly stay in that stream of information.
Yeah, that's kind of a pretty challenging part, because first of all, economics is very vast, and there are so many journals, so many outlets, and now that with internet and everything, like
right.
every day tons of things come come out. But then at the same time, it has also created, again, this is another industry. Like, there are some people who basically what they do, they look at all these things that come out and then they customize or summarize for us. So there are many internet sites or internet source where the area where I specialize, they will give a summary of everything that came out in last week.
Okay. Right?
So, for example, there is one database called REPEC, that is Research in Economics, Research Papers in Economics, or Ideas. So those are, every week I'll get an email saying that, okay, in your area of specialization, these are the papers that have come out in last week. And then, of course, I don't get time to read all of them, because sometimes these papers are heavily, they have like very heavy dose of mathematics or something. So it takes time to read all those, and sometimes it doesn't really, I mean, I don't need to read all those because I'm not exactly doing what they are doing. As long as I get the idea that, okay, this is what they are doing, I'm fine. And if I have to do something, I can always go back and look at it. So that's where I get most of the more research-oriented economics news. And then for the rest, I watch news channels, read newspapers. And so that's where, and since I teach macroeconomics or monetary economics, I have to keep like track of what the central bank is, Federal Reserve is doing, or what the US Treasury is doing, or what is going on in Europe, what is going on in Asia. So it's kind of a, and I mean, in general, I'm interested in those kind of things. I'm interested in politics, for example. American politics is it's a favorite pastime. So when I'm home, and I don't normally don't stay home for too long, but when I'm home, I'm always watching political news, like what's going on in Republican, like presidential race and all kinds of things. Yeah, so it's kind of fascinates me.
Do you find that the different, just like the political sides, have slants to economics? Because to me, I would think economics was fairly straightforward. But do you find that people, they'll put their own interpretation on it and make it, and one side, like the Republican side, makes it sound like one completely different thing, and the Democrats have decided, no, no, it means this instead?
They will focus, depending on what their goal is, what they want to achieve, they focus on one thing. Of course, when you look at an economy like the U.S. economy, which is the largest economy in the world, it's a very complex system. So depending on whether you are trying to talk to the Republican voters, so they just pick things, I guess. So it's a, and I really believe that most of these people, they understand, they have a kind of very general good understanding of the economy, but then, well, they are in politics, so so they have to use that's kind of I do think that they just pick numbers or pick information according to their convenience or according to their objective, what they want to communicate with the voters.
Okay. So what do you think about, what do you think that people can learn from looking at the Indian economy today? Because if it's still growing and still in flux, what is it that we're getting to see if we look at them versus what we've already missed because our economy in America has already been established?
Well, Indian economy, first of all, just because it has a huge population, 1.2 billion people, that means every 6th person in the world is an Indian. It's a huge market.
Yeah, that sure is, when you think of it that way.
Right, so for U.S., I would think that the U.S., at least U.S. businesses should look at India as being this market which is growing, because although we still have 1/3 of our population, Indian population, under the poverty line, But one third of the Indian population, they are actually are now middle class, who can afford a car, who can afford a house, who can. So it's a kind of a huge market.
Mm-hmm.
So from a purely business point of view, that is what, like, any businesses around the world will look at.
Okay.
The other important thing about India is that India is relatively a young nation. Has a young population,
mm-hmm.
meaning median age in India is 26 years. That means half of that 1.2 billion people are under the age of 26.
Oh wow, I feel old.
They are very young.
Wow.
So that human resource is big mm-hmm. in India. Compare it to China, and I forgot the median, and I think it's 37 or 38. So. The Chinese population is aging, and
mm-hmm.
because of their population policy, they don't have very
right.
Low. Compared to other countries, they still have a very big young population, but
mm-hmm.
it's kind of shrinking. So India has that strength. And the other interesting thing about India is that if you look at all the Asian countries which have experienced very high growth,
mm-hmm.
India is the only country which actually has a purely democratic political system. And you know the problems with democracy. It's a good system, but at the same time, well, sometimes it may not be very helpful when a country tries to grow because of all the political problems. So in spite of being a democracy where 40% of the people are illiterate,
mm-hmm.
and there are all kinds of different fractions, because India is also very diverse. There are many languages, many different ethnic groups, many different religions. Still has been able to do what India has done in the last 20 years. So that's kind of a very great thing, I guess. So those are the things that I would look at. Now,
mm-hmm.
as you sent me the questions, you talk about how India is being rated as one of the riskier countries.
Mm-hmm.
And they are basically talking about corruption, they are talking about the governance.
Okay.
They are not looking at the power that
mm-hmm.
India is based on the size of the market and the size of the young population, the human resources.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not be very worried, because corruption has been there in India and it is not very easy to kind of get rid of the
right.
corruption. It has kind of gotten into it,
the mm-hmm.
system. So although there has been political problems because of that, but then that has been the case for almost like the last 34 years.
Right.
And so I would not, well, it is vulnerable to terrorism, yes.
Mm-hmm.
We have some of the very dangerous countries around us.
Right.
Pakistan, Afghanistan. So we have to deal with that. India has to deal with that, but has been dealing with that, and occasionally there are problems. But at the same time, you also have to recognize that India has the third largest people all over the world. They talk about Islam, but then India has the third largest Muslim population in the world. Actually, India used to have the second largest. Just recently, Pakistan kind of
ousted them.
Yeah. So Indonesia, Pakistan, and then India. So, and then 80% of the people are Hindus, and
mm-hmm.
then there is 22.3% people Christians, which is even Christian population is bigger than some of the Christian countries.
Mm-hmm.
So it has got a very diverse. It's so much diversity in that country, and in spite of all that, it has been doing. I'm worried about a few things. First of all, India still has to work on infrastructure.
Okay.
It's in a bad shape. And we cannot sustain the growth that India has been experiencing unless we build India builds the infrastructure. They're working on it, but not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other problem is, in the 90s, they did all kinds of economic reforms, but lately, in the last couple of years, they have not done any major reforms. So they need some more economic reforms in certain service sectors, in certain
mm-hmm.
areas. And then the other part problem is we are still lagging behind in education. Education should be a high priority, both like elementary, secondary, and higher education.
Mm-hmm.
We need more higher education institutions. Given that size of this young population,
right.
We need more higher, good quality higher education institution. Indian skilled workers have becoming more and more expensive now, as a result of which all the countries, like Western countries, mm-hmm. they are moving actually some of their job from India to some other countries where they can get it for cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been, unless we produce a lot more engineers, a lot more scientists, it will be very hard to maintain that competitive edge that India used to have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the good things of being colonized by the British was that Indians can speak English. That was kind of a
mm-hmm.
boon for, in 1990s, when most American companies were looking for English-speaking engineers they could find in India. But that competitive edge will go soon. Go away very soon now. In fact, some of the companies are moving to Egypt. Some companies are moving to Pakistan. Pakistan is difficult because it's risky.
Mm-hmm.
But some companies are moving to Bangladesh, for example. So yeah, those are kind of the challenges that I would say that the India needs to handle on a priority basis. But I'm not, these are problems. I recognize corruption,
mm-hmm.
bad governance,
right.
But then I'm not really worried much about, it will take time. Corruption, you cannot.
No, that's difficult. So tell me, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading this, so I just wanted to show you. This is a kind of a novel.
Uh-huh.
It's called Two States. And by an Indian author,
mm-hmm.
Chetan Bhagat. It's kind of a humor book, and you can read this, and it's so it's for fun, basically. Love marriages around the world are simple. Boy loves girl, girl loves boy, they get married. In India, there are a few more steps. Boy loves girl, girl loves boy, girl's family has to love boy, boy's family has to love girl. Girl's family has to love boy's family. Boy's family has to love girl's family. Girl and boy still love each other. They get married. So,
nice.
So this is just, I've just started reading this. So
just something for fun to take your mind off.
Yeah.
Or when you read fiction, are you still seeing economics everywhere?
Nowadays, actually, more and more, I mean, I talk like an economist, I guess, because
it's just soaking into you.
I don't notice myself, but sometimes when I talk with my other friends, they said, "Oh, you're talking like an economist." Well, I think I said, but because I have done economics for most of my life, yeah.
It's become part of who you
are.
Yeah,
it's become part of me, and I kind of get excited about it.
But that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's important that you're excited and enjoy what you do.
Yeah, yeah. And then again, I mean, I told you the story how I got into economics,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't like it when I was in India. Then I came here, and then I started enjoying it. It has been part of me.
Well, that's great. So is there anything else you'd like to share with us today? Like maybe what you're currently working on or planning on writing or anything?
Just recently I finished a book chapter on U.S. services trade.
Okay.
U.S. trade in information intensive services, because one thing that politicians normally don't talk about or people don't recognize that although U.S. has a trade deficit, overall trade deficit,
mm-hmm.
if you divide trade between goods and services, in services, U.S. actually has a trade surplus. So in 2010, if I remember correctly, they have a trade surplus of $152 billion in services trade.
Wow.
And if you look at the major exporters and importers of services, U.S. is at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And this service trade has grown significantly, much faster than merchandise trade in last 10, 20 years. And U.S. has been leader. So as an economist, what do I get from that? That U.S. has a comparative advantage in trade, in services trade.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that probably will remain for many years to come. And U.S. probably should focus on services trade. Yeah. A good trade will always be big and will be big for a while. And the U.S. is a major importer of goods.
Mm-hmm.
And but then I think also, I think this services trade part will be an important part too. So that's what I worked on, and I am with one of my colleagues at the department. I'm now looking at how investment in information and communication technology affects services trade. So that's what I'm doing.
So when will you put together a book? Because you've got all these chapters and journal articles. When's
mostly
the book?
Right now I am focusing on journal articles, because that's where I get most of the value, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But then very soon I, with two of my colleagues, from UCLA, one from NPS in Monterey, we are publishing a small monograph on U.S. information economy.
Okay.
That probably will come out. There are several versions. One is a kind of a paper version, which will come out this year. I think
mm-hmm.
that the monograph, the book version, will come out next year.
Okay.
But that's what. And the other part of my life is I travel a lot, and I travel all around the world, and one-fourth of the year I'm outside the country.
Really?
So I am planning to go to India to visit my family, we'll
mm-hmm.
come back, and then go to Japan for a month. I'm taking...
Nowhere close, I see.
Yeah, taking some students for a study abroad program.
Can I be a student? I want to be a student.
Yeah. You can sign up. Sign up, yeah. Last year I was in Australia for 3 weeks, I think 3 weeks. And then was in Singapore. So I travel a lot. Yeah.
I need to go into economics if you get to travel most of these times.
But then that's
nice.
The advantage of like having a lot of co-authors all around the world.
Oh, you have to meet up with them. And
yeah, and also you have to, of course, work.
Oh, well, there's that.
but yeah, that's been the good part of
That's wonderful.
I love to travel. And I actually, in June, when I'm in India, from there I'll go to Taiwan.
Oh, wow.
For 3 days. I have a conference.
Just 3 days?
Yeah, but this should be a... When I'm home, my
mm-hmm.
parents don't like when I travel. So it has to be short.
So oh, okay.
But I have to go for a conference in Taiwan. And I'll just make a short trip, I guess.
Are you presenting anything? Or
yes,
you just
yes.
Okay.
I'm presenting the same information economy. Because I'm associated with this group called
mm-hmm.
BIT, Business Information Technologies Global Research Network,
mm-hmm.
which is actually based in at UCLA Anderson School of Management. So I'm a partner there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are people from 18 different countries.
Oh,
so
wow.
Every year we have a conference
mm-hmm.
in summer somewhere in the world. So this year it will be in Taiwan. So that's
okay.
That's where I am. And I, there is a part of that group which basically is related to the study of information economics in different countries. And there
mm-hmm.
that's the area where I work. And there are other groups. Within that
right.
group, there are other areas, like they do an industry survey. And it's a good conference because sometimes economists, and I'm kind of, I think I'll be, I'm more open in the sense that sometimes this economist, and I think that is true for any
mm-hmm.
discipline, we are very clannish. We don't want to look outside economics, but I'm not that I'm a little bit more open, and that's why I mix up with people from industry, people from management, people from operation research, information systems. And
nice.
So wherever I can see something which excites me.
Oh, that's good. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing.
Okay.
It was lots of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
I didn't know economics was so fun.
No, yeah, it's a lot of fun. And there are misperceptions, I guess. And I tell my principles class, that is the introductory economics class, that, at the airport or in the airplane, whenever I get to talk to my co-passenger and they ask what I do, then I say I'm economist, and the next thing they ask me about the stock market. And then I said I have no idea what stock market or how the stock market is doing. Or I cannot give you advice like which stocks to buy, because that's, well, just because I'm an economist, I'm, well, this is not
that's
the
not
only
your focus,
thing
yeah.
only thing that economists should do. Well, that's a part of economics. And then there are a lot of other people talk about like there are areas where as I say, it is a, you will wonder why it is in economics. People talk about marriage, people talk about divorce, people talk about childcare, people talk about many different things in economics. So it's much more, it's very interesting in a way. If you look at the different things, people talk about crime, people talk about sports. Sports economics is a big thing. One of my colleagues, you might know him, Don Freeman, he writes on alcohol, beer, and there is a conference every year, it's called Beeronomics, Economics of Beer. So he just published a chapter in a book.
Oh, that sounds like a fun conference.
Yeah, Economics of Wine, yeah. He went to Germany, he was invited.
Oh, nice.
Last year, I think, it was in Belgium.
I bet they're a fun group.
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting, yeah. It says it's kind of important to make it interesting. I think I wish I could kind of I could effectively communicate that message to my students. And sometimes students are not very much interested or excited about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm ready to take some economics. I'm ready to travel to some beer conferences and go to Japan.
It's a lot of fun.
That sounds like it.
Japan, this will be my second time that I'll be taking this. I started this study abroad program in 2010. Last year it got cancelled because the students signed up, but then the families were worried that because of the tsunami and radiation, they got worried. Although we actually go to Osaka, which is in the south. But this time, I have the students and we'll be going for 1 month. And it's a good experience for my students because they get to live with the Japanese family. And then I am the one who teaches, who will be teaching those classes. But then they get to go visit Japanese businesses. And then people from businesses, people from government, they come and then talk to the students. So it's a very good exposure.
That sounds great. Well, thank you so
much.
Appreciate it.